Silence!
Oppenheimer!
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is Nerd Right Radio!
Nerd alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 24 of Nerd Pride Radio. 24, the number of blackbirds required for my wife's famous sixpence pie. So, ask me how I'm doing today. Go on, ask me. I am awesome! My name is Mike Jones. I am a D&D nerd, a sci-fi nerd, a comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd. Plus, there's about seven other kinds of nerd that I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio, the place where I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that just won't fit in my brain anymore. As always, you're listening to the best-smelling podcast on the internet. I just discovered that Nerd Pride smells like Jean-Luc Picard's hairbrush. First off, feedback. Holy crap, and this is hot off the presses. I am not kidding. I sat down to record the podcast today, and before anything else, I open up the computer, I get everything going, and there's a brand new message from Akiva, of all people. Holy cow. So, I've only read through this once. I'm sitting down to record. Here it is, 5 minutes old. Akiva says, "Don't know if you remember me, but what, don't know if, of course I remember you, Akiva. Akiva was a fan of the old podcast, hung out on our old website forever, and podcaster himself, in fact. And, dude, I still have a picture of you in my avatar files. Of course I know who Akiva is." All right, anyway, Akiva continues, "I was active for a while on the old Animal Ball boards under this same name. Anyway, I just found out about this new site and podcast and was very happy to find out. So far, I'm enjoying the cast and the forums look good, too. Hey, thank you, dude. I am so glad to have you. Really. Stay. Hang out. We're going to have fun." But he goes on. He says, "It's a bit out of date, but I just listened to the punk rock episode because I love me some punk." I would not have guessed that, dude. That is so cool. Anyway, Akiva says, "I had a couple of comments. One, about covers. Some things you may or may not know about. First, in the DC hardcore scene, Stepping Stone was a very popular cover. I know that there are at least two cover versions on record, by Minor Threat and SOA. Another popular punk cover from the 80s was These Boots Are Made for Walkin'. I know of versions by G.I., 7 Seconds, and Operation Ivy. And finally, there's a kick-ass punk cover of 99 Red Balloons by, I think, 7 Seconds. Okay, I don't know if you've got the same version of 99 Red Balloons that I have, but it is awesome, and the dude goes through and in record time, because it's punk and they got that tempo speeded way up, he does the English version and the German version all in a single take, and it is gorgeous. I absolutely love that. The other ones, I don't know any of those versions of Boots Are Made for Walkin', and I don't even, oh, and Stepping Stone, I know the song Stepping Stone. I haven't heard covers of either one of those. I don't know. But trust me, dude, I will look them up because I love covers and I love punk covers, so that is cool. Last of all, he says, "About Celtic punk, they're not punk in the classic sense, but I'm still a bit surprised that you didn't mention the Pogues. They certainly had the speed, attitude, and abrasiveness of punk." Actually, the Pogues were listed in my notes. I had them under the post-punk section back when I did lots and lots of research for podcasts. And I don't know why I didn't mention them. I gloss over a bunch of stuff. I write down stuff just because I like to see my own stuff in writing, I guess, just like I like to listen to my own podcast. But I completely agree. Pogues make a great fit. They certainly are right in the same vein of a lot of the punk music that I really enjoy, and I enjoy the Pogues. So, anyway, I'm glad I found this place. Hey, dude, I'm glad you did too. Welcome aboard. This is awesome. Another new user, RaveMaster99, also signed up for the boards. He's made a few posts, and most importantly, he sent me some Podomatic stuff. So I'm thrilled to death. Welcome aboard, Rave. Seriously. And we have got a ton of stuff in the meticulously plotted portion today. But before that, updates. Told you guys I was reading Luke Cage Hero for Hire, later renamed the comic to Power Man, Luke Cage Power Man. And I am continuing to read that. I found some time, and I got through another 6 or 7 issues out of the book that Joel gave me. And I just wanted to update my old comments on Power Man and say that, yeah, you know what? No. The racism is actually pretty disturbing here. I said there's a lot of it that you just overlook because, well, it was the 70s, and it was something that they were trying. But the thing that's just baffling me in these last few issues is within Power Man. Oh, I'm sorry. For those of you who don't know Power Man is a Marvel superhero. He was one of the first black heroes to get his own comic book. This is back in 1971-ish, I think, so 40 years ago. And Power Man was a very black superhero. I mean, he's from the streets, he's an ex-con, wrongly accused, and he has got a series of jive talk that would put Kid Dynamite to shame. So they really went overboard to make sure that he came off as black. And what has gotten me is, lately they've been introducing some more educated black characters into the storyline. The black chemist who becomes Camistro, the black lawyer, Big Ben Donovan, and every single black guy in this entire comic book always talks with that exact same jive accent. Every single one of them. Doesn't matter what their background, doesn't matter what their education level, doesn't matter what they do for a living now. Every single one of them talks like that, and it just drives me bats. It's so glaring. And the other thing that they're doing, and I'm guessing this was gutsy at the time, but they're actually making a point now, just in the last few issues, that the white villains always make reference to his blackness. They make comments about it in a derogatory sense. And it's not outright racist, but it certainly implies that all white supervillains are racist. And I don't know what I think about that, but it is notable that that they're wanting to bring race into it a little bit more. Again, this is my review and commentary of a magazine that's 40 years old, but I'm still having a good time. And after this, he was going to give me the Iron Fist series next, because I love Iron Fist too. But I think now I'm going to get an Avengers series from way back. So we'll see. It's all up to Joel. And whatever it is, you know I'm going to bring it to you. But now we've got so much to do, we've got to get right into it. The meticulously plotted portion of this podcast. This is the time for me where I get to talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. During the course of my week, if anything strikes me as interesting, I add it to my master list. And the best stuff gets spewed out onto you guys every week when I record. You lucky dogs. So, first thing on my master list, it's time to visit my gaming table.
I've got Dungeon Master's Guide. I've got 12-sided die.
Role-playing games, video games, card games, if it fits on my gaming table, I am going to share it with you guys. And last episode, I promised that this episode I would talk about Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition. And I'm not going to run on about it for too long because here's the deal. If you're not interested in Dungeons & Dragons, then this is not going to matter to you whatsoever. Seriously, get up, go make yourself a sandwich, come on back. And if you are interested in Dungeons & Dragons, then you already know that a new edition is coming, and you've already heard way more commentary than I can present here. But in my mind, you know what? It's time to do it. I honestly know 4E hasn't been out for that long, but really, 4E was not what it should have been. I mean, seriously, you guys know me. I've barely played 4th edition. I've read the books. I understand the rules. I know what's going on with the game. And it's just not my cup of tea. And everyone I know who has played it and given it a fair shake says it's awesome. And they absolutely love it. I get that. I haven't done that. And so I'm very happy with Pathfinder. I'm very happy with this upgrade of the 3.5 rules without moving on to 4th edition. Here's what I think went wrong with 4th edition, in my very, very amateur opinion here, is I think it's because they let go of the open gaming license. Honestly, that's the bottom line. I think everything else could have been forgiven if they could have continued what they're doing here. I mean, 1st edition Dungeons & Dragons, obviously, I loved Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. I loved it, and I bought into 2nd edition, although I didn't care for it as much, but I bought into 2nd edition, and it was fine. It was just an upgrade of the same old rules. Had a great time. I was so hesitant when they came out with 3rd edition. I was so worried about what they were going to do to it in this makeover. And it turns out that 3rd edition really captured the feel of 1st and 2nd. It captured that same spirit, the same kind of history and the races and the feel of it. It felt Dungeons & Dragons to me right from the start, except with this updated D20 system that really made things more consistent. It brought in a lot of non-combat stuff to actually make it relevant and playable. It didn't mean that anyone necessarily focused on non-combat stuff. That's a personal matter. But at least that option was there, and it all kind of came together, and it made sense to me. And sure, it's got flaws. It was overbalanced in certain ways. There's all sorts of things that are wrong with it. But it worked, and it felt good, and I really enjoyed playing it. I still enjoy playing it. And so to go with that, the Open Gaming License, the OGL, then allowed this whole revolutionary concept of anyone can write for our game. Anyone can produce materials. Now, this also meant that the world produced a ton of crap. There is so much stuff that's compatible with Die 20 that has the Die 20 label on it that is just garbage. But so what? So there's a lot of garbage. There's also just more stuff overall, which means there's also more gems in there. There's more really valuable, really good stuff within that Die 20 realm, within that Open Gaming License. And I absolutely love it. And by giving away their rules, essentially that's what they did. They gave away their rules and said, here, we're going to publish Dungeons & Dragons, but for the most part, anyone who wants to can take these rules, do whatever they want with them, create supplements for our game, create your own games, whatever. And overall, it was nothing but a boon to them. Dungeons & Dragons grew to absolutely dominate again. I mean, to levels that maybe they never even had other than maybe in the beginning when they were the only game in town. But really, it was just this huge revolution in gaming for us, this renaissance in gaming, as far as I'm concerned. Combine the Open Gaming License with the freedom that the internet allows to publishers, both professional and amateur, like myself, and it was just magical. All right, and then 4th edition came along, and 4th edition changed the tone of the game. All right. You can quibble about the rules, you can quibble about all sorts of stuff, but they also changed the focus of the game, they changed the tone of it. It was no longer the Dungeons & Dragons world. It's now this new, slicker, however you want to phrase it. It was a different sort of game to play in, which doesn't mean it wasn't fun. I've got thousands of people who will testify to how awesome 4E is, but it wasn't the same game. It didn't even feel the same. And then combine that with the fact that they then took away the Open Gaming License. Oh, they promised that they were going to have their new GSL. They promised that things were going to be the same, that, oh, well, you know, there's going to be some restrictions, but in general, you'll still get to do the same stuff you did before. And they lied. It just did not pan out that way. Combine that with the, you know, failure of their online ventures. They had all sorts of promised stuff for online, and none of it worked out. I think for 5th edition, what I'm hoping and praying for is a new version of the Open Gaming License, something that truly is almost as open, if not as open, as the 3rd edition gaming license, really making use of their online presence and really doing it right this time. Since Hasbro is the parent company, they don't have the same freedom and maneuverability that they used to, and I don't think it's going to happen that way, but there's all sorts of stuff that's being promised, all sorts of stuff that we're looking ahead to, and even though we call it 5th edition, I think they're calling it D&D Next. At least that's the working name for right now. That they don't want to slap a 5th edition on it. But I'm hearing things that say it's going to be backwards compatible with every version of the game till now. That there may be like a buffet of rules to choose from, or that in some way you can bring your 4th edition characters and your 1st edition characters to the same table, and somehow everything will be compatible, or at least, you know, your gaming group can work with 5th edition and work with the licenses available and pick the set of rules that makes it work for you. I don't know. That sounds a little overwhelming and intimidating to me. I mean, if it really worked out as smoothly as they're implying, that would be gorgeous, but there's so many technical difficulties. I'm not judging 5th edition at this point. I see that there are a lot of possible pitfalls, but there's also so much good that could come out of this just for a new way of looking at gaming, bringing back some of that same energy that we had a little while ago. Not to say that the gaming industry is not energized right now, but it's different. And I liked what we had, and, you know, I'd like to see a little more of that. Maybe I'm just being nostalgic. Maybe I'm just holding on to the past. But I'm going to reserve judgment. I'm not going to say this is going to be good or bad. I wasn't fond of 4th edition, but lots of people were. 5th edition, they might screw it up really, really badly, but I'll wait and see what they actually do before I decide. That's all I got. And next up, listen to the music.
Don't know much about history.
That's right. It is the Unnamed History Segment. This is awesome. Okay, today in the History Segment, I have got the year 1066. I have already told you that 1066 is my favorite year, and I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about why that would be. First off, if you don't listen to the Hardcore History Podcast by Dan Carlin, go listen to it, because Dan Carlin is amazing. And yes, he only puts out a new episode every 2 or 3 months. Don't care. Totally worth it. The last one just came out a little while ago, and it is 4 hours long. 4 hours on post-Roman Europe. All right, so from the years 400 and some till about 700 maybe. All right, and phenomenal stuff. So go listen to that. And in that, he started talking about the womb of nations. That there are, according to his research, there are two areas of the world that are given this womb of nations label. One is in Mongolia, where out on the plains of Mongolia, where these nomadic horse tribes keep rising up over and over and over, the Avars, the Magyars, the Huns, the Mongols, that these phenomenal horse archer barbarians, these nations that swell up, and there's no written records because none of them could read or write, so there's no written records. All we know is that there was this soup of nations jostling against each other, peoples and tribes, killing each other, pushing each other out, and we would never see them until eventually the lesser tribes get pushed far enough out that they start bumping into Persia or China or Rome or whatever. And that's the only way you know that these people finally exist, is that someone else, bigger and stronger than them, has now pushed them out into quote-unquote civilized territory. Fascinating. All right, he's got a whole episode, and I don't even know if it's available for free anymore, but he's got a whole episode on Mongol horsemen, and it's just fascinating. But then the other womb of nations, and the one that was relevant for him this time around, is Scandinavia. That the same way that those Asian horse archers, those new peoples would keep developing and new tribes and kings and everything else, you got the exact same thing in Scandinavia. And we have no idea who all those people were going way back. The only time we would ever find out about them is as these Viking-style Germanic barbarians, these Nordic barbarians, are pushing each other out, slaughtering each other, moving about. Eventually they would push a peoples far enough, or someone would wander far enough, that they'd start bumping against the Roman Empire. And then, when they bumped into, again, civilized folk, then suddenly we have records of them. Suddenly someone's writing down, and he says the shame of it is that, you know, all of our records are from people who were fighting them. So we don't even have, because they didn't write anything of their own, we don't know what these people were really like. We get a good sense of their battle tactics, and we get some sense of who they were. But again, everything's written by their enemies. And it's just fascinating. And this was really his focus of this entire last podcast, as he's talking about the taming of some of these tribes and how especially the Franks and other Germanic tribes wound up, you know, bringing post-Roman civilization to France and Germany and this whole area. All right. All of that then reminded me of the end of that womb of nations. All right. This brings us up to King Harald Hardrada. Harald Hardrada was a king from Norway, and he is widely considered to be the last of the Viking kings. So his reign marked the end of the Viking era, and his death in the year 1066 is the end of the Vikings, essentially. And so this was the last, really, of those true barbarian tribes. After this point, you know, we've got pretty good records of everybody, because they're all pretty civilized at this point, relatively speaking. But Harald Hardrada is just fascinating to me. All right, he's born Harald Sigurdsson, because his dad was Sigurd. So originally, we're talking back in the year 1030, maybe, he's serving under his half-brother, King Olaf II of Norway. And they go into battle, and he's a young man at this point. They go into battle, and Olaf is killed in battle. And so Harald manages to survive, along with a number of other men, and they now have to leave Norway in shame, because they were there and allowed the king to die. And so essentially they take themselves into exile, and they wind up going to Russia for a while and staying with a distant relative there. And then from Russia, Harald travels with 500 men under his command to Constantinople. Now, Do you have any idea how far Constantinople is from Norway? This is, I mean, here, you know, we think of the last Viking king, and we have, I have a very specific image of what Vikings are like, and the idea that this Viking is going to travel with his, you know, minor army here 2,000 miles across Europe to Constantinople, the most cosmopolitan nation in the Western, or city in the Western world, it just is not what I expected. And what does he do when he gets to Constantinople? When he gets to the Eastern Roman Empire? Why, he and his men sign up to serve as part of the Varangian Guard. Varangian Guard, I think is how you pronounce it. The Varangian Guard is an elite guard serving under the Roman Emperor who are all Norsemen. They're all Northern, you know, Russian, Scandinavian, etc. And this Varangian Guard was notable because it was a bunch of these elite barbarian, you know, heavy warriors who were all incredibly tall, because Norsemen were far taller on average than the Romans. And so, you know, here's these imposing giants on the battlefield, and Harald was no exception. The man was huge. He was a giant. And he quickly, you know, he brought in 500 of his own men, and he becomes a captain in the guard, and he's promoted a couple of times, and he does really, really well. And, in fact, while he's there, they also had several changes of leadership. So he served under 3 different emperors, 4 different emperors, and every time the emperorship changes hands, every time the old one goes out and the new one comes in, there is this chance for the guard to make a bit of money. And now, whether or not it was them actually sacking the treasury and stealing some stuff, or whether it is, you know, a payoff from the new emperor to ensure their loyalty, we're not quite sure the details of it. You know, depends on which side you're on, what story you're going to tell. He had plenty of chances to make himself a little cash while he was down there. This is very important for him. He also winds up making a trip to Jerusalem, to the Holy Land, while he's there serving under the emperor. And I read a book about him called The Last Viking. It's by Paul Anderson. It's very, very good. I'm sorry, I'm going to get sidetracked. Here's the deal. This book taught me a little bit about how history is viewed, because most characters in history can be very, very sympathetic or very, very evil, depending on how you tell their story. And in Harald's case, he winds up, you know, I read from Wikipedia, and then I follow some online research, and most of the online stuff I'm finding is from the point of view of, you know, English writers who, you know, to them, he was a barbarian invader who was, you know, rightfully turned back and killed. But when you find stuff by, for example, this book by Paul Anderson, or stuff that it's by Scandinavian writers, they paint him much more sympathetically. Oh, they acknowledge that, yes, the man was extremely tough, and the man could be cruel at times, and he made some really stupid decisions, but oh, he did it all in the name of nobility and, you know, glory for his country, and it's very different. And in fact, the tale that's told in Anderson's book is this very romantic tale of adventure and high action, and would make a spectacular movie, and probably has if I would look around for it. But I've never bothered to check out a Harald Hardrada movie. But anyway, it's just very, very interesting the way it comes off. Well, eventually, he's got enough money. He's served his time. He's been in Constantinople for a decade. He spent 10 years serving under the emperor there. And now he's ready to go home. He's got the money. He's heard news of stuff back home. He's ready to go back. And he's decided that as Olaf's half-brother, that crown is rightly his, and he is going to go back and get it, by God. And so he goes to the emperor and asks, you know, permission to be dismissed, and the emperor says, nope, kind of like you here. Thanks, though. So after a couple times of this, Harald and his men plot a daring escape. And again, you know, in the book I read, it was absolutely harrowing. It was a scene to top any action movie. It was spectacular. And so him and his men, they make their way out of Constantinople under cover of darkness, and they sneak their way back to Norway, where he then eventually takes over and he becomes rightful king. Okay, and this is where he picks up his name. All right. Again, Harald Sigurdsson now becomes, and he also had a Roman name while he was down there, a Latinized version of his name, etc. But as a king, he gets the name Hardrada, Harald Hardrada. And this is because King Harald Hardrada translates to, roughly, from what I understand, to hard ruler, stern counsel. But really, honestly, that's Harald the Hardass. That's the coolest name ever. King Harald Hardrada, Harald the Hardass. I love that. I think that is so cool. Oh, I didn't even mention how he got his crown. He gets back, and his nephew, Magnus, I think, again, I didn't take notes on this one. I'm going purely on memory. His nephew, Magnus, was in charge at the time. He comes up, and he says, you know, look, hey, I'm family. By rights, you know, I should be king myself. Look, we'll rule jointly. How's that? And so they come to terms, and who knows what level of force was applied, but they come to terms, and they're like, okay, tell you what, we will rule jointly. And then within a year, Magnus was dead. Ooh, convenient. We don't know how it happened, but, well, I guess I'll take over now. Which, and all of this stems from the fact that, and these barbarian tribes going back ages, I keep saying barbarian, I don't mean that in a derogatory sense, I'm just talking about these northern Germanic and Scandinavian tribes of various sorts. I just use barbarian as a nice shorthand. But they had a tradition that screwed them over time and time again throughout history, where when the king dies, his kingdom is now divided among all of his sons. So, and as my son then says, as I'm explaining this story to him, he says, well, so doesn't that mean you quickly lose all of your power because everything's divided up into a million different little states? I said, no, that's the best part, because you have things like Harald, where Harald comes up and he says, well, you know, rightfully, you know, your dad and I should have split this kingdom, so yeah, I'll take my half, you take his half, we'll rule jointly. Oh, look, you're dead. And then he gets the whole thing. And that happened all the time, the family infighting. That's how you consolidate power again. Dad dies, we divide up the land, and then we wait around, and then eventually the strongest of the, you know, in a very Darwinian model, the strongest of the sons survives and winds up taking over pretty much the whole thing. So now, very quickly, let me get to the year 1066, because that's what this is really all about. Harald Hardrada is, well, all right, let's back up. Edward the Confessor, so named because he was king of England, and he was such a pious and holy man that they named him Edward the Confessor. Edward the Confessor dies, I believe in 1066, and leaves no heir. There's no heir whatsoever. And so now there are several people vying for the throne. The first contender is William the Conqueror, who is across the waters on the mainland. And William the Conqueror was promised the throne, supposedly promised the throne, by Edward himself. Edward had sent an envoy to him and said, look, if something happens to me, if I should die, and I have no heir to pass this on to, I want it to go to you. I want you to take over my kingdom. And the envoy that sent it over was Edward's trusted advisor, Harald Godwinson. All right, so there's a lot of Harolds here. Sorry about that. Harald Godwinson was, again, trusted advisor, minor nobility, etc., etc. But he was the king's closest friend and advisor at the time. And he personally delivered this message to William the Conqueror and said, yes, the king wants you to be the new king in his place should something happen. Okay, great. Well, now Edward is actually dead, and Harald Godwinson says, oh, you know what? Forget what I said about that. You know, maybe I could just take it over. I mean, I've been ruling, you know, in all but name anyway, so, you know, why not me? And so Harald Godwinson does exactly that, and he trumps up some kind of claim of relation and becomes the new king. And so now, of course, William the Conqueror, already been promised the throne, he's making plans to come and invade because, by God, that place is rightfully his. Now, on top of all of this, Harald Godwinson has a brother, Tostig, and I love that name, Tostig Godwinson. Tostig is an awesome name. Tostig, the brother of the new king, heads on over to Norway and buddies up to our good friend Harald Hardrada, Harald the Hardass. Harald has been waging war against the Danes forever, and it's not doing any good. He's, one, not making any progress, and two, his people really don't want it. There's no call for this. Why are you doing it? So he's given up on his war with the Danes. He needs somebody to fight, and then here comes Tostig and says, hey, do you remember that obscure bit a while back when your brother was promised that he could become the king in England if someone were... Okay, anyway, this is a long, convoluted thing. But because of it, Harald himself now has a very tenuous claim to the English throne. Again, there's nobody on either side really clamoring for it except for Tostig and Harald himself. And the claim is not nearly as strong as William's. But, hey, it's good enough. I've got no Danes left to fight, so let's head on over to England. So here's how it happens in 1066. We get Harald Hardrada and his Norse Vikings in their 300 longships. So 15,000 dudes go pushing off for England to go claim him the throne, right? And now, in England, Harold Godwinson realizes that, oh, crap. I've got William the Conqueror coming on one side. I've got Harold Hardrada coming on the other. Who do I go to first? And he hears that, okay, William's been delayed a little bit. Let's go fight off Harold. We'll get this taken care of. So, Harold Hardrada and his men land, and they wind up taking the town of York almost immediately. It's not even a challenge for them. And they're very overconfident at this point because Tostig has already told him he's going to be hailed as the conquering hero. That, trust me, the people, the nobles, they want you, Harold. Please come join us. So Harold Hardrada is very overconfident at this point. They've taken York. Things are looking good. They've heard that, hey, enemy forces aren't coming anytime soon. So you know what? It's a hot day. They take off their armor and go into town to start collecting tribute from the locals. I assume that means rape and pillage. I don't know for sure. As they're in the middle of collecting tribute, it turns out Harold Godwinson and his army come tromping on over the hill. And now they're caught with their pants down, really. And it was a slaughter, an absolute slaughter. Poor Harold the Hardass goes down in this fight. Tostig Godwinson goes down in this fight. Of the 300 longships that they brought with them, less than 25 made it back to Norway. I mean, it was a rout. It was horrifying. All right, but here's what Harold Hardrada did. Harold Hardrada occupied Harold Godwinson long enough and wore out his army well enough that when William the Conqueror showed up, poor Harold Godwinson and his English troops had to hoof it. Within a three-week period, they had to fight this huge battle with the Norse Vikings and then tromp all the way across the country down to the southern coast where they could meet William and get their butts kicked because they were in no shape to fight. William shows up, he's rested, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and they take the country without any trouble. So that, 1066, the Battle of Hastings, September, I think, was the last time that the British Isles were successfully invaded by a foreign power. All right, that's monumental. It's been 940 some. I mean, it's remote, but it is actually possible. If I live to the age of 96, it is actually possible that I will get to see the 1,000th anniversary of the Battle of Hastings. Holy crap. 1,000 years as a country? Can you just see that? It blows me away every time. And so, this is what's so monumental about that year, is that there are so many things that could have gone so many different ways. All right? Harold Godwinson's intelligence had been different if he had chosen to go fight William first. All right? And if he had gone to fight William first, he could have beat him. William the Conqueror would never have taken, the Anglo-Saxons would not have taken England if he had gotten different intelligence and had gone there first, right? And then, had he done that, the Vikings would have found an empty beach and would have shown up and gotten the run of the land for how long before this weakened army could have come up to fight him off. Who knows what could have happened in the year 1066. It just amazes me. I love that year. Anyway, this takes me back to my gaming table.
I've got Dungeon Master's Guide. I've got 12-sided die.
I just like playing the music. I'm not going to run through the spiel again. This actually takes me back to the Woden's Eye. Woden's Eye is a game concept that I wrote a while back. And never actually played it, but I love this idea. And I wish I had the write-up in front of me because I would just read it off to you because I phrased it well at that point. But I'll give you the quick summary. Imagine in the year 1060-ish, all right, imagine that King Harold the Hardass winds up being visited by an alien space probe. Okay, this is far-fetched, it sounds like, sure. But I have this whole thing drawn up. We have an alien space probe by the Galactic Federation, or whatever you call it, that these advanced beings have set probes in various systems to watch developing species. And when they're ready, these things are programmed to make first contact and welcome them into the body of peoples that inhabit the galaxy. Well, the one stationed around Earth malfunctioned, and it dives in easily a couple thousand years too early. And it winds up crashing into the North Sea. It's recovered by fishermen who, through some comedy of errors, wind up delivering it to Norway, where King Harald Hardrada, Harald the Hardass, has laid claim to it. And this space probe, again, it's designed for first contact. It's designed to handle languages and problems like this. It's designed for social interaction. And so it thinks it's making first contact. So it welcomes, you know, it invites itself in. You know, it's not a mobile thing. It's just this big sphere that answers your questions. And because it's designed for first contact with a developed nation, it assumes you already know all sorts of stuff. Well, the Vikings don't know these things, but when they ask questions, and when you find out how to ask the right questions, it gives you correct answers on physics, on alien races, on biology, on all sorts of stuff. So imagine if someone like Harald Hardrada, imagine if someone with that mindset got a hold of the ability to build any weapon he wanted. All right, well, any technology he wants, because the thing will answer all your questions. But really, at that time, Norsemen, Viking kings, what are they going to be asking for? Mostly they're going to be asking for how to defeat their enemies and how to take over the world. And so imagine this rapidly advancing culture centered around this Viking mindset, all right? And it's very warlike at first. They conquer lots. But then eventually someone starts figuring out, in my version of the story, that someone is Harald's granddaughter in the story, or great-granddaughter. And someone figures out that, wait a minute, this thing didn't come from the gods, as we've previously thought. It came from alien races, alien people, other nations out there in space who have the audacity to think that they can order us around, to think that they can send this probe down to, what, to watch on us, to keep us like animals in a zoo? All right. At this point, the peoples of Earth become very offended, because while they may have this rapid technological advance socially, they're still fairly primitive. And so what do? You know what? We're going to take the fight to the aliens. And that's what this winds up being, is these guerrilla warrior Vikings in their primitive spaceships going out to tackle this huge, monolithic, bureaucratic galactic empire that just does not have the resources to face this kind of enemy. They haven't had real enemies in space in forever. And the advantage that the Earthlings have is that, you know what, the Galactic Empire just can't react fast enough. And not only can they not react fast enough, they can't even agree on what to do, because so many people feel like, well, yeah, you know, but the Earth problem, really, we created this problem. We're the ones that made humans the way they are by giving them this technology too early. It's our fault. We really should save them and preserve them. And other people are claiming that they need to wipe out the humans like the pests that they are. And so they can't even agree on how to deal with us. And meanwhile, we're busy blowing up all their crap. I love this idea for a game. Viking terrorists in outer space makes me so happy. All of it is inspired because I think way too much about the year 1066. It was me. This was actually 2 years ago. I was at Boy Scout camp. I'm wandering through the woods on this hike. I was measuring out this trail and trying to figure out where everything went. And as I'm hiking, I just couldn't stop running over the year 1066 in my head and all the possibilities. And I don't know how I got off on the space probe tangent, but, oh, man, I fell in love with it. So that's Woden's Eye. I'm not actually going to do anything with the game because I've got other projects way ahead of that one. I just give these things to you to tease you. One day I actually would actually like to write a short story based on it, but a full game, unlikely to actually happen. And now?
And now for something completely different.
For something completely different. Yeah, this is all just stuff that I don't have a category for yet. And what's on my list today? Cookie dough. All right. If you are a person who has struggled with their weight and has serious food issues, as I do, you'll understand this. I have been overweight, well, technically obese, for most of my adult life. That's just the way it is. And recently, my wife and I have gotten on a lifestyle, a plan, a diet, whatever you want to call it, where we're actually keeping track of the calories and we're eating reasonably and eating more healthy. And between us, she's doing way better than I am, so I like to include her number in with mine so it sounds more impressive. But between us, we have lost right around 100 pounds right now, and we're doing really, really well. But, you know, there's a lot of failings. There's a lot of sliding back for me. Food is just something that I'm one of those that I can't accept a little failure and go, okay, you know what, I screwed up, but nah, that's all right. We'll just move on. We'll be good for the rest of the day. We'll be good for the rest of the week. It's all good. No, for me, you know, I screwed up. I had that extra slice of pizza, and now if I total up my calories, oh, God, I'm like 300 calories over. Well, screw it. This day's shot. Time to pig out. It's wrong, but that's the mindset I get sometimes. But, again, I'm going to get a grip on it. I'm getting myself back together. You know, I'm always going to have problems with it, but I'm looking forward to, you know, as I'm watching my calories. By the way, thanks to my brother Kyle, I use livestrong.com. I highly recommend livestrong.com. It's part of the Lance Armstrong Foundation. And I just go in and I use the MyPlate function where it just lets you track your calories. Super easy. You type in what food you ate, type in how much, boom, it tells you how many calories you have. You give it your height, weight, age, and what your weight goals are, and it tells you how many calories a day you can have. So it just tells you, you know, you can eat whatever you want, just when you get to your limit, go, oh, well, I guess I'm done. And what you wind up doing is, as you track your calories, this is the magic of it, you wind up eating more healthy because you find that if you've got to limit your calories, then the healthier food actually winds up filling you up better. For the, you feel more satisfied and more full for the amount of calories you're getting. It's really kind of cool. You wind up, you know, we didn't make a conscious effort to change our eating patterns. We just said, okay, let's just make sure we're not eating too much. That's all. And as a result, we wind up choosing better foods, making better choices. Really, really cool. But enough of that. I'm not here to preach. I'm here to talk about cookie dough. So here's the latest most sinful food in the world for me, and I can't, oh, this is such a problem for me and my diet. I love cookie dough, okay? I make no bones about that. I love cookie dough. And you know what the best cookie dough in the world is to eat, just raw cookie dough? Which, by the way, you're not supposed to eat because of the raw eggs. And yeah, whatever. The best cookie dough in the world for me is chocolate chip cookie dough minus the chocolate chips. I could eat that all frickin' day if I had the option. I love that. You just chocolate chip cookie dough, no chocolate chips. And that's why whenever we make chocolate chip cookies, I always make sure, oh, wait, before you add the chips, let me get a little spoonful of that. And so here's what I discovered recently. We had to help our kids make cookies for school a couple of times. And as I'm looking at the recipes, I've never paid attention to a recipe before for cookies. I just, you know, you pull down a recipe, you do whatever it says on the box, and then you throw them in the oven, right? That's just how cookies work. And then I realized that, wait, but there's a pattern to all these different recipes, and if I want that awesome chocolate chip cookie dough flavor minus chocolate chips, it's really easy. And it doesn't even involve the raw eggs, so I don't even have that danger. I can go into the kitchen right this moment if I want, because these ingredients are always on hand. Quarter cup of butter, quarter cup of brown sugar, quarter cup of flour. Throw it all in a bowl, mix up with a fork, and boom, within a minute and a half, I have awesome chocolate chip cookie dough. It's butter, brown sugar, flour in equal proportions, and that's it. If you do the quarter cup, quarter cup, quarter cup, okay, I'm all done. I got 350 calories worth of cookie dough, which is not terribly satisfying. Really, you need to do the half cup, at which point, man, you're just completely over for the day. But, oh, man, it is so good. It's just absolutely, absolutely sinful and outrageous that I'm even allowed to do this. I can't believe that those ingredients are just right there in my kitchen. I mean, honestly, mixing butter and sugar is really that tasty? Of course, pure sugar, pure fat. What else do you need? So I don't have a point. I'm not going anywhere with it. I'm just wanting to tell you that, oh, God, I love it, and I've got to stop doing that. It's just such an easy little snack. All right. Now it's time for the science fiction double feature.
Science fiction double feature.
That's right. Here at Nerd Pride Radio, you get not one, but two movie reviews for the same low, low price. Except today, because I didn't watch the second movie. Actually, technically, I didn't even watch the first movie, but I'm here to give you my reviews anyway. First, I talked a little bit ago about Sukiyaki Western Django by director Miike. And here's the problem I had with it as I was talking about it, because Sukiyaki Western Django is based on the original movie Yojimbo by Kurosawa, and Yojimbo inspired Fistful of Dollars and Last Man Standing and Lucky Number 11 and Sukiyaki Western Django, among others. And it occurred to me as I'm saying this that I've never watched A Fistful of Dollars. In fact, I've never seen any of the Clint Eastwood Drifter movies. I've seen just enough of Good, Bad, and the Ugly to talk about them a little bit, because it's iconic stuff, but I've never actually seen them all, and so I thought, you know, I really need to watch Fistful of Dollars. I need to start there. And then I thought, you know what? Before Fistful of Dollars, I really should start with Yojimbo. I should go right back to the source, start with Kurosawa, and do it right. So we got Yojimbo, and I got to see about 25 minutes of it before I just couldn't take it anymore. I know Kurosawa's a genius. I understand that, but I couldn't get over it. I just couldn't get through it. Every move was telegraphed so far ahead, at least for the 25 minutes I saw. Everything was so obvious, and the characters were so cartoonish. And I understand why. I understand where it's coming from. the characters that we were seeing were very buffoonish a lot of times. I mean, you had your hero, who is just your stoic Samurai Jack-style hero, and then there's a couple other serious characters, but all the bad guys, all these people around him, these rival gangs that he's supposed to play off of each other, they're all cartoons, because I think it comes out of the Kabuki theater tradition, that these are, I mean, just like, you know, Greek theater in its day had very obvious stereotypical characters, and you knew, and a lot of times with a mask involved, so you knew if someone came out wearing that mask, even though it's a different play, different character, you know what kind of character it is. You know that this is going to be the villain. This is going to be the idiot buffoon. This is going to be the evil henchman. And that's what this was. I mean, these characters came out in Yojimbo wearing this makeup. The one, you know, big, fat, obviously half a moron, and he's supposed to be a mob boss of some sort. But he's just, and he's got this monobrow going that is just ludicrous and clearly painted on there. A lot of the thugs come out in these, I mean, really, they looked like clowns. It looked like, as they come pouring out of the saloon to come face him, it honestly looked like clowns getting out of a miniature car. And I couldn't take it. I couldn't watch Yojimbo anymore. I know it's supposed to be classic. I know it's supposed to be brilliant. And yet, nope, not a chance. Not going to do it. So, there's my review. I have no rating for it whatsoever because I couldn't make it to the end. And then the other one that I was expecting to review this week, and I was going to have a great time with it, is One for the Money, because One for the Money just came out, and my wife has read all the books in that series, and she admits that, yeah, okay, after about the third one, they're pretty much all the same book. But it doesn't matter. They're funny. They're actually truly humorous books, and I've read the first couple, and I enjoyed them. They're funny. But again, as I started into the third book, I realized, okay, yeah, now I've gotten all the jokes, and there's really nowhere else to go for me. But anyway, we've both read the book. My wife really likes him. And even though One for the Money stars Katherine Heigl, who I think is a talentless lump, I was like, you know what? But she looks all right in the commercials. This could be all right. I mean, we know what we're getting into. We know it's not going to be a great movie, but you know, it could be some fun, right? Okay. So that was our full plan. We were going to go opening night, really. And then we wound up not being able to make it. And then we saw the reviews come out. And I knew it was going to be bad because there were no advance reviews whatsoever, not even a one. They didn't release it to anybody. The studio knows how bad the movie is, and therefore they don't allow anyone to review it until after opening night, and that way they can trick as many people in the theater as possible. So I knew it was going to be bad. I didn't expect 3% bad. I went to Rotten Tomatoes, and after that first night, 30 reviewers, there was only one person who gave it a positive rating, and even that person was admitting that it's still not a great movie. It's just bad. Geely levels of bad. Did Geely get 3%? No, I think it got like 8, 7. I mean, come on. This was hated. And after seeing those reviews, we looked at each other and said, yeah, you know what? I think we're just going to skip it. Eventually we may wind up getting it on DVD on a lark just because we've got to see it. But that's just painful. I feel so bad for everyone involved with that film. They should have known better. Oh no, you better get the little ones out of the room and make sure you're sitting down for this.
Nerd rage came flashing back, and I just looked at him and went, "Rrr!"
That's right, it's time for some nerd rage. Okay, I actually have two rages today, and I don't know why, because I do not have time for two rages. But you know what, Akira, it's your fault. You're the one that pushed me over time. If I hadn't had that opening letter show up at the last minute, we'd be fine. But I'm going to do them both anyway. The first one I'll make quick work of. I just heard yet another commercial for one of these auction sites online. This one I think was called BidSpot. But there's a bunch of them. There's BZids and QBids and apparently this one BidSpot. And these websites all work on the same, these auction sites, and I put that in air quotes because they're not. They're gambling sites. They all work on the exact same principle. They advertise on TV, on the radio, everywhere, talking about how you can get name brand items, name brand merchandise for 90 to 95%, sometimes even more, 95% off of the regular price. And they're not kidding. If you go to their sites, you can see the way these auctions bid up. There are actually people out there who are buying brand new iPods, a new iPod Touch, which should run for like 300 and some bucks, and they're getting it for $15 to $20. But it's the nature of the bidding that makes them so evil, and why they make my blood boil, because it's so wrong. Here's the deal. When you go to one of these bidding sites, qubits, let's say. Doesn't matter which one. The price starts off at a penny. And then if you want to put in a bid on it and you want to buy it for 2 cents, then you put in your bid. All right. And the price goes up one penny. And if someone else wants to top your 2 cents, then they put in their bid and it goes up to 3 cents, etc. Price keeps going up by a penny every time someone puts in a bid. Here's the trick. Every bid you want to put in costs you 60 cents. So let's say you play it perfectly right. You get really lucky. You could technically win with one bid. Okay. The price gets up to about its limit. You think, okay, this is it. No one else is going to bid, and you put in that last bid at the very last second, and it costs you 60 cents to put your bid in, and now you walk away with your new iPod for 15 bucks. That's possible, but not likely, because here's the deal. They have a timer on it, just like, you know, eBay or any other thing. They get the auction has a timer on it, and when it gets down to the last second and that timer goes off, all right, last second, as soon as someone puts in a new bid, if the timer is down to the last second or two, oh, timer goes back to 10 seconds. Gives you another 10 seconds for other people to get in. And okay, no one, oh, last bid. Okay, oh, goes back to 10 seconds. So even though the auction was supposed to be over, it could run another 4, 6, 8 hours as people keep adding bids on top of it. And they will. So ultimately, while you might get lucky, really, let's do some basic math. Let's apply a little nerd math to this and say, okay, let's say I got my $300 iPod for 95% off. I only paid $15 for it. Okay, $15 is 1,500 pennies. All right, are you following the math with me here? 1,500 bids went in to getting you that iPod. 1,500 bids means that company just made $900 on their $300 iPod. Holy crap. All right, and that's if you actually get that huge a discount. Actually, they're saying up to 95% off when they talk about it in the commercial. So it's possible that, you know, some of them it's only 80% off, 75% off. I'm estimating that their return on this, you buy your bids. Each bid is your lottery ticket. Each bid is your pull of the slot machine arm, okay? And for each lottery ticket you buy to one of these bidding sites, you know, you're going to get a payout of literally 20 cents on the dollar, maybe. I mean, that's honestly, overall, people are kicking in, you know, thousands of dollars for hundreds of dollars worth of stuff. And so when you look at those odds, it should be illegal. It should be regulated as gambling because that's what it is. It's, and yet it's not. They don't have to because, well, we're an auction site. We're not a gambling site. We're just paying for the bids. That's your entry fee. That's all it is. We're not gambling, but that's really what it is. And seriously, go to a decent, go to any live casino. Don't worry about the online ones for right now. Go to a real live brick and mortar casino and walk in. Do you know what the odds are on those? Do you know what their payout percentage is? Their payout percentage is 90% or better in most places. All right. Slot machines around this country, I looked it up. Slot machines in general, the lowest payout I could find was 92%, and most of them pay off at 93, 94, 95%. So for every $100 you put in, you get 93 back. Now, of course, you're going to sit there until you use that 93, and you'll get another 86 back, and then you'll spend that, and And overall, you'll eventually run out of money because, you know, the payout is less than 100%. But, you know, those few people strike it lucky, whatever. But that's a payout of 90-something percent at a real casino. That's decent odds, at least. That gives you a fair shake. You go play the lottery. Go play Powerball right now, and half of the money goes back into the Powerball jackpot, plus other money that then goes out for other payouts. So you're getting a better than 50%. I think it's closer to like 62%, 63% payout, which is not great odds compared to a casino. But at least with the lottery, you have that mega million jackpot in your eyes when you buy the ticket, and you can console yourself by knowing that all the other stuff goes to your government to go to charity and other good works for education. And the children do it for the children. Okay, but to go to a bidding site and get a payout of 20% on the dollar, less than that, God, it's a crime. I'm amazed that they're allowed to get away with it. Really am. But that's just rage number one.
Nerd rage came flashing back. And I just looked at him and went, "Rawr!"
Rage number two, if you've been on our forums, you already know this, but I can't even believe it. The Lone Ranger movie is coming out in 2013, and they've already cast, Armie Hammer, son of Armand Hammer, is going to be the Lone Ranger. All right, I'm cool with that. He's young, he's good looking, he's got that clean cut thing going on. He's as good as anyone else, I guess. I don't know him that well. And Tonto is going to be Johnny Depp. Are you kidding with me? How? Yeah, leave aside the fact that he's not even a Native American, which, all right, you know what, if you don't want to cast a Native American for a Native American role, that's on you. I really think they should in today's political and cultural climate, but okay, that's on you. But Johnny Depp, really? I can't even fathom this one, which is, and here's how it comes about, all right? They've been planning a Lone Ranger movie for a while. The property eventually winds up going to Disney. Disney gets a hold of the Lone Ranger, and they're ready to make their, because, you know, hey, Lone Ranger is a kid's show. This makes only perfect sense that Disney should take control of this. It's exactly up their alley. And they get the Lone Ranger property while they are right in the middle of filming Pirates movies. So all their Pirates of the Caribbean movies are going. Johnny Depp is the hottest commodity that they have. And when they get the Lone Ranger, honest to God, Disney says, okay, we don't know what we're going to do for a script. We don't know who we're going to cast in any of the roles for sure. All we know is Johnny Depp has to be in this movie. That was part of the condition of them taking this and doing something with it, is that Johnny Depp was going to be in this movie no matter what. I don't even know that they picked him out for Tonto right away. He just has to be in it, period. That's just infuriating. Disney takes over the Lone Ranger as a Johnny Depp vehicle. Oh, we don't know what we'll do with him, but we'll make it work. That is so against the spirit of the Lone Ranger in the first place. And on top of that, do you know who's directing? Do you? Jerry Bruckheimer. I don't even know how you can have Jerry Bruckheimer direct the Lone Ranger, because horses don't explode when they crash. Okay, which, by the way, I'm making a very firm prediction that at least one scene in the Lone Ranger, when this movie finally comes out, one scene is going to have to take place in an abandoned mine, or maybe even a current mine, but it's going to be in a mine with the mine carts racing Indiana Jones style and the whole business. And you know why it's going to be in a mine? Because that's the only place to find buckets and buckets of high explosives in the Old West. That's why. Because Jerry Bruckheimer is going to have that mine explode, and as their mine cart comes racing out on the rails out the front, that explosion is going to well up behind them, fill the whole mouth of the mine entrance, and blast out, and they will get away just barely in time. That's my prediction. That scene will be in that movie. Because how could it not at this point? I mean, it's the Lone Ranger, and it's Jerry Bruckheimer. There's no other option for this movie. Here's what really hurts. I got to talking to Joel about this, and Joel, I apologize for all the teasing I've given you, because Joel, apparently, is a huge Lone Ranger fan. I mean, like he loves the Lone Ranger the way I love Mr. Rogers, all right? Because to him, and I'm beginning to see his viewpoint, I was never a huge fan because it just wasn't in my wheelhouse as a kid. It just wasn't available to me. But to him, and I completely agree, like Mr. Rogers, like O'Toole, the Lone Ranger is a pure good. That's just who he is. That's how he was conceived. When they wrote the Lone Ranger, they wrote it as a kid's show, and they knew that there would be adults following it, and eventually adults made up more than half the audience, and everybody loved the Lone Ranger. It was extremely popular in its day, and for good reason. But when they drew it up, the people involved, the actors and writers involved, had a specific code of ethics, a code of behavior that applies to the Lone Ranger. And they needed to understand that this is who the Lone Ranger is, that he is about goodness and nobility, and you know, he's about saving people and preserving law and order and preserving this nation, advancing this great nation of ours in the Old West. And people had to understand it and buy into that that's who this character is. They had to buy into it. And some of the actors who have played him took that very seriously. I mean, they went above and beyond. You know, one of the things in the guidelines, because to go along with this code of honor for the Lone Ranger, they also drew up some guidelines to embody who and what the Lone Ranger is and how he should be portrayed in media. First of which involves the Lone Ranger is never seen without his mask on, unless he's in some sort of disguise. You don't get to see his bare face. And therefore, following the rules of logic, they said that means he can't ever be captured for any lengthy period of time, because if he's going to be captured for a while, they're going to unmask him. So therefore, you have to make sure he's not in situations where that's going to happen. And the actors took this seriously, you know, going so far as to, you know, not wanting to make public appearances without the mask on. You know, not wanting to go out, because they wanted to embody that Lone Ranger spirit. The Lone Ranger does use guns, But he never shoots to kill. He always shoots to disarm people, always shoots to disarm people as painlessly as possible, hopefully. The Lone Ranger only loads his gun with silver bullets. Do you know why? Because silver bullets are expensive. And he wants to make sure that if he's going to use his gun, that it's worth it. That there's a reason that he's going to take that risk. That he's reminding himself that life is precious, as is the silver that he uses in his weapon. Do I sound a little overblown? Maybe, but that's what the Lone Ranger inspires in you when you look into it. The Lone Ranger, they made a point, while there is some inherent racism, because this was a show produced, you know, how many decades ago in a very different environment, and there is some racism that is inherent to the culture of that time, they made great effort to make sure that Tonto was an equal partner, as an American Indian, an equal partner with the Lone Ranger. And Joel confirms this for me and says, oh, yeah. He said there was never the idea that Tonto was a sidekick. It was they were partners. And, you know, here's the Lone Ranger being our paladin, being our shining knight. And Tonto gets to be the more, do the more clandestine stuff. He gets to do the tracking and the sneaking and this kind of stuff. But they were equal partners, at least from Joel's point of view. And I take his word for it. You know, the Lone Ranger, obviously, would never drink, would never smoke. In fact, when they went into bars in the Lone Ranger TV show and radio show, when they go into bars, they made a point of making sure that they seemed more like a cafe, that there's, you know, waiters bringing you food, not some bartender serving alcohol to people. As a kid's show, they wanted to make sure that if they had unsympathetic characters, whether it's villains or people who are unsavory for whatever reason, made sure that those people never had two names. All right? It's always just a first name or just a last name. That's all they get. And in fact, even better, if they could present those characters with just a nickname, not even a real name, they would do that. Why? Because they didn't want somebody out there listening, some kid to be listening, and find out that villain has the same name that he does. They don't want that kind of vicarious association, that kind of ability for either him to feel bad because his villain's got the same name he does, or for people to make fun of him for sharing a name with a villain. That's how careful they were about this. So, to me, okay, I guess I do kind of like the Lone Ranger. I'm waxing on a little bit. I've never seen much of him. I remember watching some Lone Ranger when I was a kid. I remember enjoying it, but again, it just wasn't around much. But the more research I do on it, the more I love the Lone Ranger, and the more I'm really, really sure that Disney is going to completely screw this up. I think it's probably already a lost cause. But, hey, fingers crossed. Things could turn out for the best, right? Right? I have this hope that the Lone Ranger is going to come out and they're actually going to have writers and actors involved who looked over this code of conduct, this code of morality and ethics and justifications for why we do what we do with the Lone Ranger when we write him, when we portray him, and hope that somebody in that mix, hopefully several somebodies, took this to heart and actually could do something with it. But instead, we're probably going to wind up with a Lone Ranger surrounded by exploding mine shafts and buxom love interests and just all sorts of stuff that still don't belong in the Lone Ranger. But we'll see. Come 2013, one way or another. You guys up for a little music? Yeah, I know I am. This is, and again, not going to go on long because I've used up way too much time, but you got to listen to. This is Mumford & Sons. They've gotten some exposure lately. Maybe you've heard of them. But this is the first song by them, The Cave.
It's empty in the valley of your heart. The sun, it rises slowly as you walk away from all the fears and all the faults you've left behind. The harvest left no food for you to eat. You cannibal, you meat eater, you see. But I have seen the same, I know the shame in your defeat. But I will hold on hope, and I won't let you choke on the noose around your neck. And I'll find strength in pain, and I will change my ways. I'll know my name as it's cold again. I
Just an all-around good song. All right, we'll get more of Mumford & Sons in a minute. But first, it's time for...
I'm too sexy for my forums. Too sexy for my forums. The way I'm disco dancing.
That's right. It's time for Right Said Thread. This is where... This is basically where I just share with you a favorite moment from the Nerd Pride Radio forums from this last week. And this one was translator jokes. This was awesome. My brother started this thread to take any common joke that you think people would recognize, take it to Google Translator and translate it out to some foreign language, and then paste that back in and translate it back to English, and then see what kind of joke you get. And I've just got a few samples of them because I love these. Google Translator is very funny. Stan gave us a joke translated to Hebrew and back. This one is, two men enter the bar, the third dove. I love that. It's classic. The one that I submitted, the at least my favorite that I submitted, went through Hebrew, and some Australians take screw bulb. Four, one to hold the bulb, and three others to leave the chair. One from Zen, translated into Azerbaijani. A man walks up to the bar and says, I will make some H2O. A man, that sounds good, I will be H2O, says the second man has died. That one baffled me because he gave like six versions of that one in different languages. And for the life of me, I could not remember the original joke. I mean, it's funny because, and they're all translating it out in the same stupid way. No matter what language he was using, it all came out with the same gist, and I'm like, God, I should know that, and I don't. And finally, I placed it. Should I tell you the joke, or would that ruin the whole effect that we're going for here? This is all right. I'll tell you anyway. A man walks into a bar and says, "I'll have some H2O," and another guy sitting next to him says, "Hey, that sounds good. I'll have some H2O too." He drank it and died. There you go. The last one I'm going to do, and this one I love because it is just, it's profound. This one comes from Stan. He went through Japanese, and he says, yes, this is how the Japanese show their wisdom. Quote, I once shot a tiger in my pajamas. Did he become my pajamas? I'll never know. God, that may be my new tagline. I love that. But that was Right Said Thread, and that leads us now into
the badass movie quote of the week.
All right. I have been wanting to do this one for ages. I have been putting it off because I am intimidated as all hell by this quote. I'm afraid I can't do it justice. I won't even explain. I'm just going to go into it. I'll explain afterwards, but you'll recognize it right away. All right. And if it really, really sucks, you know I'm going to clip it out. But, oh man, hopefully I got the balls to do this. Let's see what we can do. No! Wire hangers! What's wire hangers doing in this closet when I told you no wire hangers ever? I work till I'm half dead, and I hear people say, she's getting old. And what do I get? A daughter who cares as much about the beautiful dresses I give her as she cares about me. What's wire hangers doing in this closet? Answer me! I buy you beautiful dresses, and you treat them like they were some dish rag. You do. $300 dress on a wire hanger. We'll see how many you've got if they're hidden in here somewhere. We'll see. We'll see. Get out of that bed, Christine. All of this is coming out. 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 You got any more? We're going to see how many wire hangers you've got in this closet. Oh, wire hangers. Why? Why, Christine? Get out of that bed. Get out of that bed. You live in the most beautiful house in Brentwood, and you don't care if your clothes are stretched out from wire hangers in your room. It looks like some $2 a week furnished room in some two-bit backstreet town in Oklahoma. I love that quote. That's Faye Dunaway playing Joan Crawford in the movie Mommy Dearest as she beats her daughter with a wire hanger. I love that quote. That is one of the best because, and I can't even do it justice. I cannot overact nearly to the level that Faye Dunaway did in that scene. My hat is off to her. I have been watching that scene on YouTube over and over and over trying to get this just right, and I still screwed it up completely. I don't care. That is an awesome quote. So, there you go. Let's do some more music. Mumford & Sons, The Little Lion Man, my favorite.
yourself, my man. You'll never be what is in your heart. Weep, little lion man. You're not as brave as you were at the start. Rate yourself and rake yourself. Take all the courage you have left and waste it on fixing all the problems that you made in your own head. But it was not your fault but mine, and it was your heart on the line. I really f***ed it up this time, didn't I, my dear? Didn't I, my... My man, you know that you have seen this all before.
Yeah, I am telling you, the moment I heard that song, I fell in love with it. That Mumford & Sons is just awesome, and I love that bit. Not going to rave on too much about it, just to tell you, it's awesome. Which brings us straight to the Pod-O-Matic! Hot dog! This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 and his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble. He rolls up random topics for me to talk about. Where these topics come from, you ask? Well, that's where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? Well, send your question or topic to me by email, or better yet, send it to me in a private message on our forums. I will add it to the Pod-O-Matic list. Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. And the first one is number 19. This is from Sirius Paul, who says, have you ever killed a beholder in any edition of Dungeons & Dragons? Nope. Not a once. In fact, as far as I can remember, I don't think I've ever faced a beholder in any way as a player. And in my vast game mastering experience, I don't think I've ever used a beholder. I have drawn one up for a third edition. I drew up a beholder with some sorcerer class levels, and he was going to be my big bad guy for a campaign that just never did get started. But I loved him. And that's it. Yeah, I love beholders. I think they're really cool. Never actually used one. Number 84 from Stan. Stan says, are we done with Ryan Reynolds? Oh, I don't know. I've never even thought about it. I mean, you know, Ryan Reynolds is all dreamy and stuff, but that's about it. I don't know. I never thought much about him. Although he's going to be Deadpool again. I mean, in a Deadpool movie, Deadpool, which... after the way they screwed up the last one, I don't know how it's going to go over, but we'll see. He could be cool. He didn't seem nearly as quippy as I would have expected him to be in the Wolverine movie, but hey, he's got some time to develop as a human being. We'll see. I don't know. Number 88 from Sirius Paul again. Sirius Paul still dominates. Do you know why? Because he has over half the entries. You guys want to beat Sirius Paul? You got to send me some more stuff. Number 88 says, if the princess from Zelda fought Princess Peach, which of us goes to jail first? Well, first off, she has a name. Her name is Zelda. So, Zelda and Peach. You know what? I don't know that I would necessarily pay to see that one, but I would certainly watch it on BitTorrent if I could get it streaming. I mean, that'd be a pretty good fight, right? And ultimately, sadly, as talented as she is made out to be in some versions of Mario, Princess Peach would lose because Princess Zelda in later versions has become a full-fledged ninja and she would totally kick ass on Peach. So that wasn't the actual question you were asking, but that is who would win. Number 40. Hey, this makes number 3 for Sirius Paul today. Why can't they make a Star Wars movie that doesn't suck in recent decades? Because George Lucas won't die. George Lucas won't retire. George Lucas won't let go. That's why. I mean, that's pretty handy, I think. I'm not judging, but George Lucas sucks. And here's the other thing, though. They're coming out with Episode 1 being re-released in 3D, and then you would assume Episode 2 and 3 will follow. And I saw it, and I'm like, God, yet another way for Lucas to rape us out of our money. Great. Thanks, Lucas. But then a tie-in came to me, a tie-in who saw Episode 1 years ago, and he would have been, I mean, he's only 13, 14 now, so, you know, how old was he when that first one came out? Barely remembers it. So, we're watching the ad, and there it is, Episode 1 in 3D. And he looks at me with the hopeful eyes and says, can we go see that together? Oh, God, my heart breaks. How can I turn that down? I mean, and I think, I'm hoping that, you know, I've seen it a couple times now, and I think I can enjoy it. I mean, it'll be in 3D. It'll be on the big screen. I know what I'm getting into. I think, in, you know, the intervening years, I think my mind has really driven this thing down lower than even it really deserves. And so maybe I can enjoy it for the good parts it does have. Yeah, you know, I can enjoy it for the special effects. I can enjoy it for the action. I can enjoy those pieces of it. Because I know what I'm going into. So I'm actually kind of looking forward to it. Number 51. Ooh, Zimney Pot. Hey, Zimney. Zimney says, if you are outside, what are you most likely doing? I'm not outside. What a stupid question. 97. This one's from the Phantom. I can't believe there are still Phantom questions in here. That's awesome. Phantom, by the way, is our anonymous account on the board. So if you go to nerdprideradio.com/forums and you go in, there's a thread up in the first forum at the top. There's a thread that tells you how to sign on as the Phantom. It's just an open account with an open password. So if you want to sign on and post anonymously, you can always do that. And that's where this came from. So Anonymous Phantom says, which species reigns supreme, cats or dogs? You know, dogs, clearly. I mean, but here's the deal. Before you cat lovers get all over me, I am a cat person, all right? I love cats. I would prefer cats to dogs, but dogs are still the superior being, and I'll tell you why. The animals serve two completely different purposes, all right? If you want a pet who is there when it's convenient, all right, if you're out a lot and you want a pet that's there for you when you come home, if it's in the mood, but when you're not there, it takes care of itself. It's got its litter box. It's got its food. It takes care of itself, really. I mean, yes, you still have to take care of a cat. You still have to get to the doctor. You have to clean the litter box, make sure the food's full, blah, blah, blah. But it's a low-maintenance pet and really nice that way. And you know what? If you wander off, as long as it's got a place to poop and something to eat, you can wander off for days and the cat really will be fine, right? Whereas a dog to me is more about the love, all right? A dog can offer you companionship and love like a cat can't. And I know there's lots of cat owners who will, you're probably not listening to this podcast, but if they heard me say that, there's a lot of cat owners who are probably railing against their iTunes right now going, all right, but I get it, all right? You love your cats. But I've had dogs, I've had cats, and I like cats better. I do. But I will tell you that a dog can love you like a cat never will, all right? A dog loves you and worships you because that's what's bred into them. They are social animals with a built-in hierarchy, and it's hardwired in them to love you. Oh, you can't beat that. It's a biological imperative. Ah, they are your slaves. Right, whereas a cat, cat's a loner. Cat will take you, leave you, whatever. As long as you're useful, it's good. And yeah, okay, there can be affection there. Whatever. Not like a dog. All right, but because of that, a dog needs love. All right, a dog needs someone to take care of it and play with it and be there for it. A dog is an investment. You've got to work for a dog. All right, you don't have to do crap for a cat, but you got to work to own a dog. So you want that payoff, you've got to put into it. And man, that is a lot of work. So there you go. Dogs win, but man, at what cost? At what cost? And I'm telling you, before I get to R2, hold on, R2, I am looking at the recording here as it goes by me, and even my silences, hold on. Yeah, see, there's a silence right there. It's fuzzy. It's just occurring to me now that I am 121 minutes into my recording. 121, an hour and 21. Now that I'm an hour and 21 minutes into my recording, I'm getting this fuzzy silence. There is some kind of static or interference. I'm really worried about the sound quality on this one. I wish I had noticed that earlier, but I've got so much other stuff on the screen, I wasn't even looking at the audio. Oh, man. Well, we're going to hope for the best, and if it buzzes in your ear a little bit, I'm sorry. That's just the price you pay for this kind of quality material. All right? So what'd you give me, R2? Oh, R2 gives me number 8. Oh, again from Sirius Paul? Why do French people smell? Well, because they have functioning olfactory nerves, same as me and you. Duh. I mean, unless they've had, you know, some major nasal or sinus injury, all French people smell. That's just the way they are. 92 comes from Brasky. Brasky says, instant game. Oh, crap. I'm going to have to think now. All right. The world, near future. Technology, Bronze Age. Game style, anime. You're just making this stuff up now. Mood, grim. Mood, grim and romantic? Villain, mechanical artificial intelligence. And plot hook, natural disaster. Go! I can't even think that fast. Hold, jeez. All right, I'm stalling. Okay, wait. All right, near future. Plot hook, natural disaster. So it's near future, but we've got primitive technology, grim, romantic. I'm going to go with Waterworld. Do I win? 6-6, number 66 from Sirius Paul. What was your favorite He-Man character? I don't have a clue. I don't even remember watching He-Man. I was just barely too old for He-Man when it came out, and I never got into it. I was just starting high school, I think, and so I had, you know, bigger fish to fry, like playing Dungeons and Dragons and fantasizing about girls who would never speak to me. So, can't help you, man. Number 15 from Scree. Yeah, you thought I was going to say Sirius Paul again, didn't you? No, this one's from Scree. Scree says, what is your opinion of Ask a Ninja? I never looked at Ask a Ninja. I understand the concept. I know what it is. But I've never looked. I assume that he's a fake ninja who would get his butt kicked by any respectable pirate. Well, any ninja would get their butt kicked by a respectable pirate, much less this fake internet ninja. But, yeah, I don't know. I have no opinion on that. We'll have to ask the boards because I've never been there. 25. Now this one's from Sirius Paul. Wouldn't it be cool to play a Red Dawn-inspired Twilight 2000 game? Wouldn't it? How did you even know? I just yesterday moved Red Dawn up to the top of my Netflix queue. Because, okay, first, I've got to watch the new Planet of the Apes movie, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, because everyone in my family has seen this movie except me, and I have to watch it. But right after Planet of the Apes, my next pick is the original Red Dawn. I am so excited to see this movie, and I'm guessing it's not going to hold up. I have no idea. I watched that movie one time when I was a kid. I watched it one time. It was a VHS copy back when I was 15, I think. Lived in New York. I don't remember. And I remember loving it at the time. I have heard so many jokes and comments about it lately. I think it's going to be dated and it's going to be silly. And I don't care. Wolverines! I can't wait, all right? And I put it up there because, well, the new one's coming out, right? So, and the new one, of course, is going to be Communist Chinese instead of Communist Russian, so it'll be all updated and modern and stuff. I can't wait. Oh, wait, I'm sorry, I was just about to roll, and I realized that, but you asked, how cool would it be to play a Twilight 2000 game based on Red Dawn? Well, I've never played Twilight 2000, but I understand. Yeah, absolutely. Right? I could do that. Number 19. Again with the Sirius Paul. Seriously, Paul? Mario or Luigi? Luigi, clearly. I mean, well, you know what? No, I've changed my mind. I've changed my mind. Mario, because I always did like Luigi because he wasn't Mario. He was like the anti-Mario, more so than Wario. And so therefore it was always cool to be the alternative, I'm not there in the mainstream. But then I found out that, you know what, a lot of people feel that way. And when you look at it seriously, Mario A looks cooler, and Luigi is really just kind of a buffoon. He's just kind of a goon. He's kind of a simpleton. He's the dumb older brother. Well, taller brother, not older necessarily. He's the dumb one, and I can't respect that. So I'm going to switch my answer. It's something I've been kind of wavering about, and I'm glad that you brought this question here to bring it into focus for me so I could settle this once and for all. Yeah, I know Mario, definitely. Last one, number 63, from Sirius Paul to close us out. Sirius Paul says, Who would train a giant owl to ride? I mean, seriously. Yeah, no, really, who would train a giant owl to ride? Idiots who don't have access to griffins, apparently. Griffon! This podcast is copyright 2012 by Nerd Pride Radio. The featured music this week was Mumford & Sons with The Cave and Little Lion Man. The opening and closing theme is from the Beastie Boys' Sabotage, as performed by the Penelopes. The bumper clips are taken from Weezer's in the Garage, Sam Cooke's Wonderful World, and Richard O'Brien's science fiction double feature. All bumper music is available on iTunes. Check it out. Buy those songs. I would not put them in my show if I didn't love them. If you feel like doing something nice for this podcast, head on over to iTunes. Write us a nice review. If you want to contact me, you can always email me at mike@nerdprideradio.com or check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdprideradio. But to be totally honest, the best way to talk to me is to come sign up for our forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. Sign up, send me a message, we'll hang out together, we will have fun. Anti-Captain, Part 3. Often referred to as the Anti-Captain by Trek fans and experts, Samuel LaForge was instrumental in the formation of the Allied Continuum, and he is also credited with facilitating the transition of the entire Star Trek dynasty into this modern era, and pretty much ensuring the near-manic popularity that it has enjoyed ever since. And it did all of this. He did all of this. Quite by accident. Captain Sam LaForge led the crew of Star Trek Legacy. This was a short-lived revival of the Trek dynasty at the end of the 21st century. Now, Legacy only recorded 30 episodes. They were three mini-season, quote, mini-season story arcs that aired over about 16 months. Four of those episodes even, the ones most critical, in fact, for later Trek developments, weren't even seen publicly until almost a decade later. The series ended rather abruptly, over bitter contract disputes among three of the main leads, and couple that with the tragic on-set death of actress Hala Kemmel, who played LaForge's first officer, Commander Dathena Crusher. It all died, and the episodes languished for almost 9 years. Star Trek Legacy was neither a commercial nor critical success when it originally ran in 2096 and 2097. At its inception, Legacy was dismissed by many critics as a shallow attempt to cash in on the Star Trek name. Let me read to you from a review that came from contemporary critic Guy Taggart. He wrote this of the pilot episode in a science fiction periodical of the day called 12 Section F. Mr. Taggart writes, quote, "As a devoted Treknik, I approached the return of the Enterprise with more than a little trepidation. It's been almost 70 years since we've seen the Enterprise sail under a new captain, and it's hard to imagine being able to live up to the legacy, as it were, of Kirk and Picard and Cyril. But on the other hand, after four seasons of the wonderfully inventive New Terra series, there was always hope that the writers could breathe something truly new and original into a revamped Enterprise. My hope was misplaced and short-lived. Unlike the wonderful New Terra series, which expands the Star Trek universe with rich and believable cultures and thoughtful and engaging characters, Legacy seems content to limit itself to that which has already been run into the ground, while capitalizing on name recognition and shock value. The producers call it a return to the spirit of the original, but it has neither spirit nor originality. Instead, the writers inundate us with familiar names by reviving the USS Enterprise, yet again, and crewing it with the offspring, descendants, and derivatives of past Trek favorites. Veteran movie villain Cray Harding is utterly unconvincing as the new captain, Samuel W. LaForge, grandson of Geordi. Harding scrapes his way around the Enterprise bridge like an angry, hunched crustacean, spitting out Shatner-esque lines as if the Tritoness tastes as foul as it sounds. The rest of the crew are played by only moderately talented newcomers. The offenses to true fans are too numerous to list, but if the lay readers will grant me a geek moment as a committed Trekkie, the ones that most offended my sensibilities were the half-Romulan great-great-granddaughter of Hikaru Sulu, a biobot imprinted with the template of Janice Tharn's murdered son, and, most grievously, the half-Betazoid, half-Klingon offspring of Deanna Troi and Worf, cast out from a parallel universe, stranded in our real Star Trek world, and then mentored by Lore at Starfleet Academy. Did it sound like I just made that up? Because I can only wish that I had. Simply the idea that this bizarre band of spoiled progeny should somehow pass muster at Starfleet is laughable all by itself. But more than that, the thought that they then all ended up simultaneously crewing the flagship of the most powerful force in the galaxy? Well, it's totally beyond belief. At least for a committed fan like myself. Okay, geek mode off. Painful premise aside, though, this show itself is entirely unwatchable. Most of the characters are downright unlikable. The Enterprise is a chaotic place of hidden vices and petty sophomoric infighting. Apparently, the writers of Legacy have yet to learn that being shocking is not the same as being interesting. End quote. Now, Taggart continues on in this vein for a while, and then sums it up by giving Star Trek Legacy's premiere episode a rating of 0.8 out of 5. Now, he may have been the harshest critic of the time, but that sentiment was actually widely shared among critics. And it seemed that the public agreed that Legacy's cancellation halfway through its third season raised nary a yip from the Trekkers around the world. Debates rose among the devoted that parts of Legacy, maybe even all of Legacy, should really be declared as non-canon material, some sort of aberrant alternate universe Trek that could be overwritten later, relegating it to the same backwater as 1701C, Tales of Starfleet, the two reboot movie series. But at the time, franchise control was in limbo, and you could hardly find a person or entity that you could call the official spokesperson, much less someone willing to make pronouncements on story content. Years later, though, after burrowing its way free of a mountain of legal red tape, Star Trek Legacy was syndicated for mass consumption, including the release of the newly edited, never-seen-before final episodes. Surprisingly, the show found unexpected popularity in that re-release. It energized a new wave of Trek mania, spawned the two now-classic series, Trek Continuum and Star Trek Parallels. Although itself initially set aside by a public who was recovering from years of strife, seeking refuge in happier entertainments than this, Legacy later became, and remains, one of the most popular Star Trek endeavors among fans. It is credited not just with revitalizing the Star Trek properties for a mass audience, but also with creating a new fervor for science and science fiction that lasted for over 40 years. Even today, in today's nostalgia-rich media halls, Legacy episodes are some of the most reenacted of all the series, behind only the original series, and the role of Samuel LaForge is now considered a rite of passage for any serious Trekkan actor. End of part 3.